Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Astonishing news, finally out of a dig in Montana this weekend, the fossilized thigh bone of a 70-million-year-old Tyrannosaurus rex has been cracked open, and inside, soft tissue, the kind that could crack open our understanding of dinosaur life and maybe deliver dinosaur DNA to 21st century Homo sapiens. Tonight on Point, dinosaur discoveries, Jurassic Park dreams. But first, we begin tonight in Indonesia, where an 8.7 magnitude earthquake has struck off the west coast of Sumatra. The epicenter is very close to that of the earthquake of December 26th that triggered a tsunami that left 300,000 people dead or missing across Asia. Fears of a new tsunami have now pushed tens of thousands of Indonesians to flee their homes again. Jason Tejasukmana is Indonesian correspondent for Time magazine. He joins us from the Indonesian capital of Jakarta. Jason, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
So what's the latest news? A big quake undersea again. How much destruction, how much damage this time?
Well, it looks like it's not damage in the same area as the December 26th quake. This took place closer to North Sumatra, which is actually south of Aceh. So far, it looks like at least 300 dead on the island of Nias, which is off the west coast of North Sumatra, and a lot of damage on the smaller islands around there. But in the main cities like Medan, the coast on the capital of North Sumatra, it doesn't appear to have been that bad in terms of damage. But in terms of panic, the scenes were pretty grim.
Jason, can you describe for us how did news of the undersea earthquake get to people in Indonesia, in Sumatra this time? There was so much talk last time that they had no warning. Was there warning this time, and how have people responded?
No, it doesn't appear that there was that much warning other than just the quake itself hitting and people running down to the streets. But it does seem like there's more procedures in order, or at least now in place, for people to follow when something happens like this. They know where to run or how to avoid it or what not to do in the case of an emergency. But it's more the fear of a tsunami, and I don't think there's any real significant tsunami warning system in place yet in Indonesia.
What's your sense of how people have responded? How many people have left the coastline when they felt the earthquake?
Oh, I don't think you would have had enough time to do that. I mean, that would involve having, you know, an hour, 2 hours notice and then heading out. I don't think we saw anything like that. So in that sense, there wasn't a whole lot of warning beforehand for people to get prepared and then to leave the area. It may have just been this case like it was, you know, with the tsunami, you know, a few months ago. It's like it happens in one area and the word travels and it gets there, and by then it could be too late. I'm not really sure yet exactly why the damage hasn't been as bad as before, but probably because there has not been any tsunami. It's been purely an earthquake, which is bad enough as it is, but not quite as devastating, you know, as it was 3 months ago.
Jason, is this quake being described as related to the undersea earthquake of December that caused so much destruction? Is this being considered an aftershock? I suppose, in some sense, all quakes in the same region are related, but how closely related to the last one?
You know, I'm not sure technically. It's certainly along a similar fault line, and the epicenter is not that far from where the epicenter was last time. I don't think it could be considered an aftershock. There's actually, since the quake last night, there's been aftershocks, you know, close to 5 on the Richter scale since then. And those are being described as the aftershocks to this quake, you know. So, but I'm sure it's related because, I'm not an expert in this, obviously, but in Aceh, for the past 3 months, nearly every week, you know, several times a week, there's aftershocks. Quake just keeps rumbling and rumbling and rumbling and rumbling. I guess it shifts, you know, a few hundred kilometers to a slightly different location, but the shocks and the tremors are there, reminding these people just about every day, you know, of what happened and what could happen.
So the grinding goes on undersea. Jason, thank you very much for joining us.
All right, no problem.
Jason Tejasukmana, Indonesia correspondent for Time magazine, he spoke with us from Jakarta. First, there was the movie Jurassic Park. It imagined a world where great dinosaurs of the distant past were cloned into modern-day life, leaving a fictional scientist to worry about the consequences.
I don't want to jump to any conclusions, but look. Dinosaurs and man, two species separated by 65 million years of evolution, have just been suddenly thrown back into the mix together. How can we possibly have the slightest idea what to expect?
Then, last week, came the public announcement that the thigh bone of a Tyrannosaurus rex has been found with soft tissue inside, intact. The T-Rex soft tissue was found in 2003 by a team led by renowned fossil hunter Jack Horner. Their discovery was detailed this weekend in a paper in the journal Science, and now the whole world wonders, in an age of sophisticated genetic analysis and cloning, what this new discovery may mean. Up next on Point, the flesh of a Tyrannosaurus rex in 21st century hands. You can join the conversation tonight. Can you believe we're looking at a T-Rex's soft tissue 70 million years after it lived? And what's your dream outcome from this new discovery? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Jack Horner, John P. Horner to be exact, curator of paleontology at Montana State University's Museum of the Rockies. He's also professor of paleontology at Montana State and led the research team that found the T-Rex soft tissue in Montana's Hell Creek Formation. Dr. Horner's been involved in the discovery of many dinosaur firsts and was technical advisor to director Steven Spielberg on the movie Jurassic Park and its sequel, The Lost World. He joins me now from Bozeman, Montana. Jack Horner, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're very welcome.
Now, let's lay it to rest right off the bat. There's a lot to talk about here, and there's genetics to talk about, but what we're not hearing straight out of this is a Jurassic Park scenario. That's not, at least so far, the kind of tissue that you found, or is it?
Well, we don't know that yet, but I suspect not.
And that's because, is there intact DNA in this material, or do you know yet?
We have no idea, but DNA appears to break down over time, and so even if there is some DNA, there's probably not very much.
Jack Horner, can you describe exactly what was going on at the dig in northeastern Montana where this Tyrannosaurus rex was found, how much of the skeleton was there, and when did you know that something different was going on?
Well, it's kind of a fun story. It was found by my field crew chief, who, of course, we were out looking for dinosaurs, and dinosaurs are rare. It was found by Bob Harmon, and Bob was out wandering around looking for stuff. I told him to go find a duckbill dinosaur, because I really don't care much for T-Rex. And he was out wandering around, and he didn't find anything, and he got into a box canyon, climbed up on a hill, had lunch. After lunch, he turned around, and he could see a foot bone of a T-Rex sticking out of a cliff above him.
Okay.
And he climbed up there, and he couldn't reach it. It was on the bottom of a 60-foot cliff, but he just couldn't reach it. And so he crawled back down the 20-foot cliff he was sitting on and walked a couple miles back to camp, and he got himself a folding chair.
Now, that high-tech device, the folding chair.
I told him later he was supposed to go back and get graduate students, but he went back and got a folding chair,
yeah,
brought it back, stacked up some rocks, balanced the chair on it, climbed up and took the bone out. And while he was up there, he saw a couple more T-Rex bones. And so I came out later to look at it and decided that it could have a lot of potential. The bone was preserved exquisitely, and so we decided to do a test pit. So we took out a crew with mountain climbing skills, and they belayed themselves off a cliff and excavated several hundred cubic yards of rock down to the specimen, and when they got down to it, they found the hind legs of the T-Rex. And the site is very remote. It is way out in the hills. It's out in the Badlands. There are no roads to it. It's near a lake, but it's still a three-mile walk from the lake to the site. Mm. We couldn't put roads into it, and so the Windway Corporation out of Wisconsin lent us a helicopter, and we flew all of our equipment in, and then we used the helicopter to fly the bones out.
But this big thigh bone with all the mineralized deposit around it was too big for the chopper, we read.
It was. We made too big of a jacket, and the helicopter couldn't lift it, and so we had to break it in two.
You looked inside at some point. When did you realize there was soft tissue in here?
Well, we didn't. There were really, when you break something open like that, you don't see anything unusual. And the first thing you want to do is preserve it so that it won't fall apart. But I had a graduate student, Mary Schweitzer, who is now working at North Carolina State University, and the kind of material that she needs is the inner parts of bone before they have any kind of preservative on them. So when we broke the bone, it gave us an opportunity to excavate some of the bone out of the middle and send it off to Mary.
We asked Mary to be with us tonight. She was tied up and couldn't join us, but it was she who said, hey, we've got soft tissue here.
That's correct. Well, actually, she discovered something else that actually, to me, is more exciting, and I can't tell you about it because it's a paper that is presently in review in Science as well.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Is it on an island somewhere off the Pacific coast? Jack Horner, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We want to learn a lot more tonight. We're so glad you're with us. We're talking tonight about the head-turning new dinosaur discovery in Montana, 70-million-year-old soft tissue in the thigh bone of a T-Rex. You can join the conversation tonight. Doesn't it just figure it's a Tyrannosaurus Rex, the ultimate eye-popping dinosaur? What do you think? What can we learn here? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the softer side of the Tyrannosaurus Rex, soft tissue found inside a thigh bone in northeastern Montana. Jack Horner was a leader of that expedition. You just heard how he was there with his crew, the foot bone sticking out of a cliff in the near Badlands of Montana, and suddenly, later here, we read soft tissue from maybe 70 million years ago. You can join the conversation tonight. Can you believe we're looking at T-Rex soft tissue 70 million years after this creature lived? Are you hoping scientists find valuable DNA in the gooey stuff of the T-Rex thigh bone? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Jack Horner. He's joining us from Bozeman, Montana. He's curator of paleontology at the Museum of the Rockies, professor of paleontology at Montana State. Lots of firsts here. He discovered the first dinosaur eggs in the Western Hemisphere, the first evidence of dinosaur colonial nesting, the first evidence of parental care among dinosaurs, and now with his crew graduate students and former students, this very big one. Lots of heads turning to stare at this. Jack Horner, you're a little mysterious about what all you've discovered here, but what can you tell us about what was inside that thigh bone? Was it when you say soft tissue, was it soft to the touch? Would it only be understood as soft to a scientist with the right instruments? Describe what was really in there.
Well, basically what Mary did was we were after something else, as I was telling you, that we can't talk about. And in the process of trying to get at this, she decalcified the bone. Now, this is a normal procedure with regular bone. If you're interested in tissues, you just sort of you use acid and you eat away the hard tissue of the bone, the calcium, and get down to the soft tissues. And so when she decalcified this bone, it actually left a soft tissue, which is the blood vessels and what appear to be in contents in what we call osteocytes, which are bone cells. And there are also red, what for all the world look like red blood cells inside the vessels. The vessels are three-dimensional, they're round, and they're flexible.
How on earth could anything remain flexible for 65 or 70 million years buried in the earth, Jack Warner?
Well, I think the most important thing to remember is that, you know, basically everything, that the vessels are made of cells, they're made of molecules, and, you know, frankly, we don't know how long some of these biomolecules last. We think of soft tissue as being something that rots away easily, but we're not, you know, we don't know too much about them, so we don't know how long it takes these molecules to break down through time.
The T-Rex, of course, very large and very dense thigh bones because they were supporting the entire weight of that huge carnivore.
That's right, and this material is coming out of, you know, of an area very deep in this dense bone. So we know that soft tissues like vessels and cells break down very quickly when they're in organs, and probably has a lot to do with bacteria. But inside this bone, and we also, Mary's also told me that heavy metals will fix some of these things, fix cells and, you know, stop them from rotting away.
You've got scientists around the country just sort of wide-eyed over this. I'm looking here at Ohio University's Lawrence Whitmer. He says it's a tremendous thing. It's the first time for anything this old. And if we can start getting the biomolecules of these animals, that will take us to a place we've never been. What is the new terrain opened up, the new possibility of understanding opened up by this soft tissue, Jack Horner?
Well, we don't know. I mean, I guess probably the most important thing is that you don't want to, we don't know what kinds of questions we can ask yet. The first thing we have to do is analyze it chemically to find out what the material really is. And that hasn't been done yet.
And on the DNA side, is there a chance if there are nuclei here? Does that mean there's DNA necessarily? If there's DNA,
necessarily no. I mean, you know, there's mammoth elephants frozen in the tundra that you know are 10,000 years old, and they don't have, you know, their DNA is not all there.
If there's fragmentary DNA, does it mean anything, or would it just be a jumble?
Well, it's probably not a jumble. If it's fragmentary, that means some of it's together. But what we can learn from it depends on how much there is. Remember in the movie Jurassic Park when they didn't have quite all the DNA, so they added a little frog DNA to it,
and that was the beginning of the end.
Yeah. Well, I mean that's the, you know, all life basically has some DNA that's exactly the same. So,
when you were advising Steven Spielberg on that movie, of course that's some years ago. Now here we've got soft tissue. Did you scratch your head back then and say, you know, this is a preposterous thesis, this will never happen? Has the soft tissue discovery made you think that there's something to it? Help us lay people understand. We hear about cloning all the time now. Now you've got dinosaur flesh in your lab.
Well, even if we had a whole strand of DNA, we still wouldn't be able to make a dinosaur. When we clone nowadays, we clone using cells. We take a cell and we make, you know, we encourage that cell to divide, and it continues to divide until there's an animal.
Mm-hmm.
DNA is not a cell. DNA is a component of a cell,
mm-hmm.
and we haven't got a clue how to turn DNA on and make it do anything. We're knee-deep in the stuff, and we don't really know what to do with it.
Jack Horner, stand by if you would. I want to welcome into our conversation from New Haven, Connecticut, Carl Zimmer. He's author of the cover story in April's edition of Discover Magazine, 9 Big Questions About Dinosaurs, a science writer whose work has appeared all over the place. Carl Zimmer, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been writing about dinosaurs, the big questions about dinosaurs. Here comes news of this soft tissue. How does this fit into the picture of remaining mega questions about dinosaurs on your plate, Carl?
Well, I think for starters, it just shows just how incredibly vibrant the whole field of dinosaur biology is. There's just these discoveries just keep coming out all the time. This discovery actually just came out after my article came out. I mean, I almost wish that I had waited a month to write it.
Because, a lot more to chew on here.
Yeah, and I suspect there's going to be more coming from Dr. Horner and his colleagues. It's going to be just as spectacular.
He's hinting very hard tonight at that, yes.
Yes, and so, yeah, I mean, the paleontologists are discovering new species, several new species every year. And what's more is that they're really starting to look at these animals as biologists look at living animals, really as we see tonight down at the cellular level. I mean, even if they don't manage to find any DNA, it's still a great find, and it'll probably tell us a lot about dinosaur physiology, because if you look at their cells, you might get some idea about, you know, perhaps what their metabolism was like or something like that. As the technology gets better for looking at these remains in more and more sophisticated ways, paleontologists are just going to learn more and more about them.
Jack Horner, the thing, of course, about Jurassic Park that got everyone's attention was it made dinosaurs, fictionally anyway, directly relate to modern life. How do you see your research? It illuminates the deep past enormously and maybe much more to come. Does it illuminate our current life on Earth?
Well, that's a good... Are you trying to get to whether dinosaurs, you know, they don't put food on our table or gas in our car, but...
We don't ask that they do, but they lived here. They were of a different scale than anything we're familiar with, and they passed completely from the planet. All that makes us very curious about them, and in a time when, you know, we're thinking about our environment today, I just wonder if these discoveries shed light on the world that's around us right now.
Well, I think every aspect of anything that's ever lived on Earth gives us a snapshot of the history of our planet, and anything historical certainly can be applied to the present and certainly the future.
And what about this Hell Creek area in northeastern Montana? I'm reading here that so many fossils have been discovered there of ancient clams, sharks, sturgeon, turtles, lizards, crocodiles. Why, and two dozen species of dinosaurs, why such a rich hunting ground for fossil hunters?
Well, it's mostly because it's exposed at the surface of the ground, and the Missouri River flows through it and gives us lots of exposure to look at. Basically, that's really the best ingredient, is having the right age rock at the surface of the ground and having it broken up enough so that you get lots of surface area to look at.
The kind of place where the foot bone of a T-Rex might just be sticking out 60 feet up a cliff. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to turn to them. Frank is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Dr. Horner, back when Jurassic Park came out, I was a TV reporter in Montana and did an interview with you in Billings, and that was about the time, well, at that time, you were talking about how these Tyrannosaurus rexes were actually scavengers, not the predators that they're made out to be in the movie. And I'll quickly ask this question, hang up and take your answer off the air. But my question is, does the discovery of this potential DNA relate the Tyrannosaurus rex to this ostrich bone that, or I'm reading that it's related to an ostrich bone? And if so, does that further your hypothesis that dinosaurs are related to birds and that they are probably scavengers rather than predators? And have a good one. I hope to get back to Montana and see you at the museum.
Great question, Frank. Thanks.
That's a pretty complicated question, but
Maybe take the ostrich bone piece. They've been
yeah,
compared to that. Why?
Well, birds are the descendants of dinosaurs, and we have very good evidence for that. So it's best to compare the dinosaur to something that, you know, that it's related to.
Okay.
None of this stuff relates to T-Rex as a scavenger, however, and people will always argue with me, and mostly sixth graders.
Because they want it to be a fierce carnivore.
Of course.
You think it was a scavenger that is sort of eating up dead stuff left around. A carnivore,
yes,
but...
Yes, well, yeah, and predators are very rare in an ecosystem. I mean, the predator-prey ratio, there can be 100 prey items for one predator. Tyrannosaurus rex is one of the most common dinosaurs in the Hell Creek Formation. Much higher concentration, much higher numbers of them than you would ever expect for a predator, and there's lots of other features.
So more like buzzards than lions.
Right.
Now, what about diet, sexual maturity, whether the specimen was male or female? Do you expect to be able to learn those things?
Yes, we will know one of the, we will know all. We actually know that it died at about age 18.
What was the lifespan of a T-Rex?
We don't know. The oldest one we know of is the skeleton Sioux at Field Museum, and it's somewhere around 25.
So was this a fully mature Tyrannosaurus Rex? Or?
No, it wasn't. It was what we would call a subadult.
So not as big as it might be, but still this thigh bone was something like 3 feet long.
Yeah, it's still a good-sized animal. It's not a baby.
No baby. Joe's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I appreciate it. Congratulations on a wonderful discovery. I just have two quick questions. I'll take the answer off the air. If there is any DNA, would you be looking at doing PCR on it so you could excrete it, or looking at maybe doing some genomic optical mapping on it so at least there could be some bits of the picture put together? Thank you.
Yeah,
we've got Joe. He's asking if you could do PCR on it. You'll have to define that for us. And
yeah,
genomic optical mapping. What are we talking about here exactly?
If we can get any DNA, we'll do everything we can with it. But right now we're not really looking for DNA. The first thing we need to do is figure out what the stuff is that we have and what makes and why it's flexible, why it's soft. So what we have to do is the chemical analyses of these soft tissues, and then we'll look for DNA, and if we get DNA, we'll do some PCR on it.
PCR meaning?
Polymerase chain reaction. Is that, Carl, are you there?
Yeah, polymerase chain reaction.
Right.
What does that mean, Carl?
Basically what you do is you're able to grab little fragments of DNA that may be in your sample, and you can replicate them and make lots and lots of copies of them, and then you basically get enough copies that you can sequence them. And that's, for example, how DNA from Neanderthals has been isolated and sequenced. And
that's
what forensic experts use to isolate DNA, you know, in crime scenes or something like that. It's a standard method.
But unfortunately, you still can't make a T-Rex out of it.
Right. Carl, let me ask you, Jack Horner's being very responsible tonight, and he's reminding us that cloning is done from cells. Even if you have all the DNA, you don't have a cell to clone. But, of course, you know people's imagination will be working overtime on this. Is there a horizon out there where DNA can be, you know, really seen as a recipe, turned into material life, turned into cells, I don't know what you'd even call it. I guess it's not cloning, but the possibility of creatures made simply from the recipe of DNA.
You're talking about dinosaurs?
Well, anything. But now that we potentially have dinosaur DNA, dinosaurs included.
Well, when it comes to dinosaurs, I'd say almost certainly not, just because when you look at the track record with ancient DNA, once you go past even 100,000 years, the track record really falls off. And it's just because DNA is a very fragile molecule.
Mm-hmm.
And even when people isolate DNA, say, from a Neanderthal 40,000 years ago, they don't get the whole genome out. They're happy if they get, you know, a tiny fraction of 1% of that DNA out. And that tells you a huge amount. I mean, when it comes to Neanderthals, for example, you can look at the sequence and compare it to living humans and say, it looks like Neanderthals were a completely separate branch of human evolution. So, it's always possible that a little bit of DNA may come out of this dinosaur fossil or another one, and that would be fantastic. You could say, for example, test the hypothesis that birds evolved from dinosaurs. I mean, it's pretty clear that they did, but you could test it again by comparing their DNA. But you're not going to be able to clone one.
Just because the material's not there, that's that. It's
well,
too
it would be like, for example, it would be like saying, "Okay, I want to make this fabulous angel food cake. I have an egg,
right.
You know."
Right.
And someone would say, "Well, where's the milk and the flour and everything else?" You'd be like, "Well, I have the egg,
and the recipe, maybe."
Right. No, I'm just saying that, right. Or maybe someone, you know, ripped out, you know, a quarter of the recipe out of a cookbook and gave it to you and said, right. Well, here you go. And you'd say, where's the rest? And you'd say, well, we can't find it.
Right. Right. So Mary Schweitzer, Jack Horner, will have all this under her knife and microscope. And the first thing she's looking for now in this soft tissue?
Just analyzing it to see what it is, see what it's made out of.
And when you look at what it's made out of, is it familiar material?
Well, it'd be nice to know if it's actually made of amino acids or if there are proteins present.
Because the proteins would give you?
Well, at least it would be a biological tissue.
if it's soft tissue, what would it be other than biological?
Well, that's a good question. But I don't think we go in with the assumption that it is until we can do our analyses.
Wow, the mysteries thicken here. Jack Horner, Carl Zimmer, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the head-turning new dinosaur discovery in Montana, 70-million-year-old soft tissue in the thigh bone of a T-Rex. You can join us tonight. Can you imagine T-Rex tissue somehow staying soft, resisting fossilization for all those millions of years? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the softer side of the Tyrannosaurus Rex pulled out of a cliff in Montana a couple of years ago now, and the new report just out that there was soft tissue inside the thigh bone of that great dinosaur. We're joined tonight by Jack Horner, curator of paleontology at the Museum of the Rockies, professor of paleontology at Montana State University. He led the research team that was in those hills that pulled out that thigh bone, also by Carl Zimmer, author of a cover story in April's edition of Discover Magazine, 9 Big Questions About Dinosaurs. You can join us as well tonight. Does this exchange between prehistoric times and today excite you or scare you or both? And if soft T-Rex tissue is still buried in the earth after 70 million years, what else might be buried in there? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. We are joined now from New Haven, Connecticut, by Derek Briggs, professor of geology and geophysics at Yale University, curator in charge of the invertebrate paleontology exhibit at the Peabody Museum. He's an expert on the preservation and evolutionary significance of soft tissues in fossils. Derek Briggs, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
So your first reaction to the news of this discovery coming out of Montana, is this big news for you, Dr. Briggs?
I think it's very exciting news in the sense that nothing like this has ever been reported from dinosaur material before.
And why do you think that is? Why now? Why not before?
I think, to be honest, probably because people haven't looked. Most people who work on dinosaurs are concerned with the morphology of the animal and in reconstructing it, and therefore in the skeleton itself rather than in the interior of those bones.
And when you see or read about what's in there, how do you make sense of it still being soft?
Well, I make sense of it in the context of some of the things that have been done in this kind of field over the years, which essentially starts with much younger fossils and works backwards. And people have established through that kind of procedure that the chemistry of the living organism tends to become altered as one goes back in time. And to some extent, this appears to be time-dependent.
Of course. So, you're describing the process of fossilization,
yes.
I guess.
Yes.
So, and almost everything is fossilized from this time. But here, inside the bone, not. Jack Horner's pointing out this very dense bone, and I don't know if it was dry or wet. Jack Horner, were the circumstances, the environment of it special?
Well, if you're talking to me, I don't know. Derek is the expert on all of this stuff, and I'd just soon listen to him.
Oh, well, let's hear it. Derek Briggs, are you imagining that is it more likely to be kept soft if it's in a wet environment, a dry environment?
I think it will depend on the environment when the animal originally perished, because what has to happen is that the initial phases of decay, which normally wipe out any of this very delicate material inside a bone and, of course, the rest of the organism, what's there before you're left with just a skeleton, Those conditions have to be special at the outset for something to survive and be available for fossilization.
And if you could get your hands on this soft tissue, Derek Briggs, what would you be first looking for?
I think I'd do exactly what Jack has described his intentions are, which is to analyze the chemistry of the material that remains, because it's astonishing in appearance and extraordinarily similar to tissues in living ostrich bones, as indeed Mary and the team have shown. But what we don't actually know is what its chemical composition is.
Would you be expecting to find a very strange chemical composition? It's a broad question, but I mean, are we likely to find that 70 million years ago life operated on a different basis than it does today?
Not at all. No, I don't think so. I think what we'll find is that the original molecular material has recombined in various ways. In a sense, there are carbon atoms in the molecules that make up proteins and DNA and the other substances that would have been inside dinosaur bones. And I suspect that those compounds have recombined into longer chains, into polymers, which are probably much more resistant to decay over time. And sadly, my expectation would be that there will be no trace of DNA and possibly even no trace of proteins. It would be extraordinary if there were in material of this age. Not impossible, because we simply don't know, but certainly extraordinary.
When you say you're expecting that this will have changed into polymers, that is, it will have changed its form dramatically from the form it had when it was part of a living creature.
Its chemistry, yes. Not its morphology, because as we can see, it's essentially identical to materials in modern bird bones. But I think its composition is likely to have changed quite dramatically through time.
Not, in this case, becoming a fossil, but a polymer.
Well, it depends on what you...
How you describe, define a fossil?
I describe, yes, just becoming fossil. And I think this, I mean, this material has been fossilized. It's extraordinarily preserved, but I would still describe the process as fossilization.
Though not what we think of as that kind of a brittle fossil. Ed's calling from Bow, New Hampshire. Hi, Ed, you're on the air.
Well, hi, I think this is a really exciting subject. And I have a question that would be, is this technique that was used to discover the soft tissue a new technique? And could this be used to perhaps go back and look at other bone discoveries in the past and perhaps find similar soft tissue?
Well, that's a great question. Derek Briggs, how about it? Are people going to be cracking open bones in museums all over the world now to see if there's soft tissue inside?
I suspect they will, to the extent that curators will allow them to do so. No, I think it opens up very exciting new possibilities. And, of course, this is attracting a great deal of attention because... and quite properly, because it's a tyrannosaur bone and because it's an extraordinary preservation. But it's quite possible that this kind of preservation might occur in crocodiles and turtles and indeed mammals in vertebrate bones of a variety of different ages. And that's really what makes it increasingly important, because a single discovery has some potential for working out what's going on. But if you have the possibility of a large number of different discoveries in different bones, you really have the potential for a new field.
And Ed is asking if there's been a new technique applied here to searching out the soft tissue, or if it's just bothering to do it at all.
I don't think it's a new technique, but obviously Mary Schweitzer or Jack would be the person to address that. But certainly they've done something that has been very painstaking and extraordinarily careful, because, of course, they were conscious that this was going to be quite astonishing, and therefore people had to be assured that it really was coming out of the bone in the condition that it appears to have.
Jack, a new technique applied here as Mary dealt with this tissue?
No new technique. The same old thing we do with modern bone.
But just this time done with one maybe 70 million years old. Fred is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Well, good evening. Thank you very much. These are extraordinary people who know so much about what was existing 70 years ago.
Or 70 million.
70 million. One of the questions I find disturbing in some respects is the fact that we want these answers so quickly, and it falls into the technology drift that we've enjoyed over the last 30 to 35 years of technological development. And all of a sudden we're saying, hey, why can't we have these answers today? It took 77 million years to develop it.
Right. But yet you must understand that appetite. Once it's there and we know we've got all the technology to look at, or some, you can't help but have the questions pop up.
I agree and I understand, but I think that the specialists need to remind us that answering that question takes time.
It's a great thought. Jack Horner, 70 million years in the ground, and now it's been out for less than two. Do you picture, I don't know, decades or centuries of research being done on this material?
Certainly, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we've been doing cellular studies, histological studies for decades, and now we're getting more into the molecular end, and I see no reason why it would stop. As our machines get better, our questions get better.
And Derek Briggs, I think you heard earlier, Jack Horner's being a little bit hard to get on some of the future insights that they hope to glean, I guess, from this material. Can you expose what might be his agenda here? Is it obvious to you what else might lie in here as yet unannounced? I know you don't know specifically, but if you were hypothesizing.
I wouldn't dare try to second guess him, and I certainly haven't seen the paper. But I imagine that they're pursuing an agenda that involves looking for exceptionally preserved organic remains in the bones of some of these dinosaurs.
Yeah, well, that's what's on the table. Jason's calling from Youngsville, North Carolina. Hi, Jason, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I was just curious as to whether or not folks who have a young Earth creationist perspective had maybe turned this argument around and said, oh, this isn't evidence of really old, well-preserved tissue, but this is evidence that dinosaurs and other creatures that we think are ancient have really existed up until recently. But I'll take this question off the air.
And let me just ask you, Jason, when you say young Earth creationist, I guess this is the kind of view of history that puts it in terms of biblical time frame rather than millions and millions of years.
Yeah, folks that would say that, you know, the whole universe or planet has only been around for, you know, 5,000 or 10,000 years.
Right, so no wonder the tissue is still soft. Jason, thanks for your call. Jack Horner, how do you respond to that?
Well, it's easy to do stuff like that if you ignore all of the data that we have about the age of the Earth and chemistry and physics and geology.
That's ignoring quite a lot.
Well, it is, and that seems to be a problem with me. I mean, science is about setting up hypotheses and trying to falsify your hypotheses, trying to find evidence that it's not right, that it's false. Young Earth creationists have a whole different way of doing what they call science, and they try to find evidence to show that their ideas are true, which is the opposite of science. So it's pretty hard to make an argument one way or the other. I mean, I think the way we're attempting to do our science is pretty good. We're always looking for critical review. We're always looking for someone to falsify our hypotheses.
And it doesn't suggest to you a 5,000-year-old bone.
Well, it certainly doesn't. It suggests that we've got preservation that we don't understand.
Yeah. Carl Zimmer, I want to ask you, one of the questions that you raise in your article is this issue of just how warm-blooded dinosaurs were. There's been question about this, whether they were warm-blooded, unlike other reptiles. Why is that still an open question, Carl?
Well, the problem is that there's no sort of Rosetta Stone. There's nothing that you could look at, point at, and say, aha, they were definitely warm-blooded. So it all has to be done more indirectly. And I would say most of the paleontologists I've spoken to have believed that dinosaurs were to some degree warm-blooded and may have differed from one species to another. I mean, if you were a really big dinosaur, your problem may not so much be staying warm as not getting too hot, because you might just store up too much energy, too much heat, I should say. But clearly, birds, which are dinosaurs, are warm-blooded, and so the question is, well, when did that start? And perhaps even the ancestors of dinosaurs themselves were a little warm-blooded. It's a big open question, and there are a lot of different ways of getting at it. I mean, Jack Horner and his colleagues, one clue they've been looking at is how quickly dinosaurs grow. and dinosaurs grow really fast, and that might suggest that they have a metabolism that we would call warm-blooded. It's not an open-and-shut case, but it's certainly suggestive.
Jack, how about it? Do you expect to learn more about how dinosaurs got so very large from this tissue?
Well, I don't know if this will help us, but that's one of the things that we're looking at. I mean, we are interested. Right? That's what our lab here in Montana is looking at, is growth rates and attempting to look at physiologies. And I think we have very good evidence that dinosaurs were, the word warm-blooded is kind of an odd word to begin with, but the question is, what was the physiology of dinosaurs like?
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly way different than any living animal we would call a reptile, much more similar to animals like birds. Their growth rates are just off the scale. I mean, you know, dinosaurs hatch out of their eggs at 16 inches long and are 9 feet long at the end of the first year.
Wow.
I mean, you don't want to have a pet one.
No. Well, but I can think of a lot of theme parks that
and
would.
Eat you out of house and home, and then eat your house.
Right. Derek Briggs, you know, we just can't help applying current issues to this. I mean, in an era where we've got supersized baseball players on steroids and all the rest, when we look into rainforests and to all kinds of life forms to try and find cures for diseases and understand life more intimately, can you imagine a time, maybe we're there already, when medicine and genetics will look not only across existing species lines, but across eons to try and understand health, maybe even to look for cures?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think probably there's a sense in which the history of diseases in archaeological terms is already informing some of our ideas about epidemiology and how problems like that might develop in the future. But I'm not sure that deep time or soft tissues in dinosaurs is necessarily going to tell us a great deal about the spread of disease in the present context.
Just too far away in time and material environment to be relevant there today?
Yes, I think the archaeology side of things is much more likely to be informative in that regard.
And again, on bones around the world, now that this has been done, I hear in your imagination, Derek Briggs, a kind of cracking of open of museum treasures all over the place to look at their soft tissue there. Not necessarily 70 million years old, but all kinds of information busting out.
Absolutely. I think the awareness that there's the potential for this kind of preservation opens a new door in terms of research. I mean, to date, the amount of information about soft tissue preservation in dinosaurs is really very small. It's just a handful of examples. And most of them don't involve organic remains, but rather the transformation of organs to a mineral, in a sense, turning information to stone, a kind of Medusa effect. So that where you get original organic material, you open up another kind of rather exciting possibility.
And Jack Horner, you've made a lot of discoveries. Are you looking now into museums and bones already in hand, or back out into those badlands in northeastern Montana? Where's your next target for discovery?
Well, we open up just about everything in our collection, and we've got thousands of dinosaurs, but, you know, you never have enough, so I'll be out again this summer.
All right, off you go. Jack Horner, thank you so much for being with us tonight from Bozeman, Montana.
You're welcome.
And Carl Zimmer, author of the article in Discover Magazine, 9 Big Questions About Dinosaurs. Thanks for being with us, Carl.
Thank you.
And Derek Briggs at Yale University. Wonderful to have you tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
There it is, a story from 70 million years ago, soft tissue and the T-Rex. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.